This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Your Memorial Day weekend travel could be a bit quicker now that the Goldsboro Bypass is open. The 20-mile stretch takes motorists from the western end of Wayne County to Lenoir County near LaGrange, circumventing stoplights and notoriously confusing exits in Goldsboro. While some construction projects are wrapping up, some are just getting started along our coast. Last week, the first piling of the Bonner Bridge replacement was installed, and on Wednesday, NCDOT got the green light to move forward with another bridge replacement project along NC-12 a few miles down the road at Redanthe. I spoke with Communications Manager for Strategic Initiatives with DOT, Nicole Meister, about the proposed 2.4-mile span, which will be built in an area susceptible to storm damage during hurricanes.
Particularly after Hurricane Irene caused the breach there, and Hurricane Sandy came through, it caused even more damage. We have been looking at alternatives for maintaining traffic along that stretch of highway, and one of those options, what we determined after doing multiple studies, is a bridge. So we looked at two different bridges in particular, one that would follow pretty much the same path that NC-12 does now, and the other was a bridge that started north Redanthe and went out into the Sound and then came in into Redanthe.
Earlier this week, the Federal Highway Administration granted permission for NCDOT to move forward with this project after going through a revised version of the plan for the bridge. What details did you change?
So we went back after we had public meetings in January 2014 and heard from the public that they preferred the new location alternative, which is the bridge that goes into Pamlico Sound. So we went back and revised our environmental documents and are now moving forward with the preferred option of the bridge, and Federal Highways just recently improved that revised document.
When I look at the map and the plans for this new bridge, it looks a lot like the Bonner Bridge. It's not quite as big, but the shape of it is very similar. And I understand the technical term for this is called a jug handle bridge. What exactly does that mean?
Well, if you look at the design of it from an aerial view looking down, it looks kind of like a jug handle coming off of NC-12 out into Pamlico Sound. So that's why it's been kind of termed the jug handle, particularly locally. So we use that to help describe it because that is kind of what it looks like from in the design.
So when the bridge is built, it's going to take motorists from Redanthe over the Pamlico Sound and drop them off on the southern end of Pea Island National Wildlife Refuge?
Right. And what it's going to do is this, and then this option actually has the least impacts to the refuge. It has fewer impacts than the other options. It'll take folks around this part that where we've had the most problems from the ocean overwash, and that's where we did the beach nourishment project a couple years ago. So that was just short term until we could look at a more permanent solution such as the bridge. And so it'll help avoid that area, which is the most vulnerable through here.
I think of the original Bonner Bridge. When it was built, it only had a 30-year lifespan, and DOT had to do a lot of maintenance to keep it safe for motorists. When you talk about this bridge in Redanthe being a permanent solution, how is DOT going to take that into consideration when it's designing it so it's able to stand up to these harsh coastal conditions and hurricanes and tropical storms?
Redanthe is very similar to Bonner in that this is meant to be a long-term solution. This is not a temporary bridge like what we had to put in place after Hurricane Irene on Pea Island. And yeah, we have learned, obviously, Pamlico Sound is not as harsh of an environment as Oregon Inlet with the turbulent current that we have in Oregon Inlet. It brings its own challenge. But as far as materials such as the concrete and the reinforcing steel, things like that, to stand up better in the salty air of the coast, and then yeah, what we handle with hurricanes and different things, we definitely have better information and technology now.
So now that you have approval to move forward, how soon could construction start?
It actually hasn't. We don't have final designs on it yet because this is going to be a design build project, just like Bonner Bridge. And what that allows us to do is we can, instead of designing in-house first or having a firm design the whole project, and then we move forward letting construction contract, it kind of helps us speed that process along, and we award one contract to a team that has designers and a contractor to build it, so that some steps can simultaneously happen together. And we've already started the process to hire that contractor or that team. We hope to award a contract by fall of this year to help move the project along.
And I understand that DOT is planning a round of public meetings coming up this summer to talk about the preferred alternative.
We'll have three meetings along the Outer Banks to have folks will present this new alternative and give them a chance to learn more about it. And also, we welcome any comments from the public, just like last time. They help us make, you know, better decisions. And we'll put out an announcement as soon as we have those meeting dates scheduled.
Nicole Meister is the Communications Manager for Strategic Initiatives with the North Carolina Department of Transportation. Nicole, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks.
This week on the Down East Journal, we begin our Beyond Binary series on underrepresented people in eastern North Carolina who fall outside traditional socio-political distinctions. One of the fastest growing demographics in eastern North Carolina is also one of its least defined. Since the turn of the 21st century, the state has witnessed a dramatic uptick in unaffiliated voters. They're threatening to break the 2 million mark by the November election, but just how independent are independent voters? Chris Thomas has more.
A former longtime resident of Onslow County and the daughter of a Marine, Dee Bigelow, considers herself a God and country conservative who gives issues like strict interpretations of the Constitution and traditional marriage laws high value.
We have a government that has a constitution, and we have delineated roles for each branch of our government. And I feel like those have become all mishmashed, and people have been sort of doing their own thing. And I would like to see us get back to, you know, what our Constitution is all about and paying attention to the clearly defined roles that each branch has.
But unlike many conservatives, she believes marijuana laws should be repealed, an opinion shared by Tony Mercando, a Pitt County resident originally from Massachusetts. He holds primarily leftist ideals with socialist leanings and prefers diplomacy to combat.
I find war and combat very interesting, but at the same time I realize that it's not the way that things should be. We're supposed to be better than this. You know, we fought two world wars, countless people died. Like, we shouldn't be resorting to dropping bombs as easily as we do.
They come from different backgrounds, different generations, and different ends of the political spectrum. But they have at least two things in common. They have roots in eastern North Carolina, and they're both part of a national political trend, the rising tide of unaffiliated voters. Thomas Seaman is a political science professor at East Carolina University and says unaffiliated voters in North Carolina are diverse, though they tend to be white, young, and born elsewhere.
A disproportionate number of people who move in from out of state, and a lot of people are doing that, choose the unaffiliated path.
According to a 2015 study by the Pew Research Center, registered independents surpassed members of both political parties at about the start of the Obama administration, and their ranks continue swelling. North Carolina is a key example of this trend, and statistics from the State Board of Elections show the number of unaffiliated voters has doubled since 2004. It serves as a source of hope for C.L. Cook of Elizabeth City.
It does seem to be a groundswell of people that are finally waking up and pretty well disgusted with national politics as usual.
Reasons for breaking from the two major parties vary widely. Like many unaffiliated voters, Mr. Mercando hasn't found a secure home in the political parties found on the North Carolina ballot. He remembers a broader variety of choices back in Massachusetts and favors the Democratic Socialist leanings of Dr. Jill Stein and her Green Party. They, and similar parties, will be on the ballot throughout New England, but probably not in North Carolina, though a petition for their inclusion is active until June 1st.
And also there's a lot of flexibility in saying you're unaffiliated because if for some reason some wonderful candidate that I completely agree with pops up on the other party, you know, it gives you the flexibility to kind of drift where you need to without actually having to go in and file a whole bunch of paperwork.
For her part, Ms. Bigelow says it's a combination of personal political philosophy and the state's semi-open primary system.
I don't always fit within the lines of either party, but I've liked candidates from each. So I like to be able to vote for people who I think should be running, regardless of what their party affiliation is.
Many unaffiliated voters feel they don't have a place in either political party, like Tea Party conservatives and right-leaning populists who tend to side with Donald Trump. The latter carried most counties in eastern North Carolina during the last GOP primary. The rate of growth among unaffiliated voters has grown at a swift clip in the east. The sharpest increases observed were in Greene County, at 187%, and Ms. Bigelow's former home in Onslow County, at 145%. But across the board, Mr. Cook believes people are sick of a system that's nearly as old as the nation.
They feel that it's pretty much a rigged system. We want to be more independent-minded, and we're looking for candidates, I think, that won't be puppets of the Central Committee or the Democrat National Committee or the Republican National Committee or the state parties.
This is new territory for North Carolina, once one of the most reliable states in the Union for Republicans and Democrats at different times. Like much of the South during the early to mid-20th century, Democrats dominated politics on the state and national level. That changed during the Nixon administration, as Republicans deployed their Southern strategy, targeting social conservatives who were once out of reach, known as Dixiecrats, once the core of the eastern North Carolina contingency. Dr. Eamon describes the shift in the state.
For many, many years, the Democrats held control of North Carolina. Finally, in 1972, a Republican, moderate Republican, Jim Holzhauser, was elected governor of the state. And then in the 1980s, Jim Martin, a Republican, was elected governor of the state, both in 1984 and 1988.
But something happened in North Carolina in 2008. It turned purple. The state shocked the electorate and gave, then, Senator Barack Obama his narrowest victory of the night. Meanwhile, North Carolina's unaffiliated voter count grew by nearly 500,000 from the previous presidential election, from about 900,000 to a little more than 1.4 million registered voters by the end of 2008. The trend continued into 2012, and as of May 21st, the count has risen to 1.9 million individuals. Dr. Eamon believes if this continues, North Carolina will be in uncharted political waters.
If the present trends continue, and if the political parties remain as polarized as they are now, I could see the unaffiliating voters overtaking both the Republicans and the Democrats, perhaps in just a few years.
That's the kind of future Mr. Cook, a libertarian, is hoping for. He believes the two-party system's success has been at the expense of underprivileged districts like his. According to statistics from the Center for American Progress, about a quarter of residents in the 1st District, covering northeastern counties like Bertie and Halifax, live below the poverty line, though those are based on the former congressional map.
The microcosm part of it has to do with the choices that the delegation and or the representatives have made to improve their own quality of life by aligning themselves with their donors, rather than working for the needs of the population that resides in the congressional district.
But Mr. Cook still has his doubts about third parties, independent candidates, and their chances in North Carolina on the national level. For now, he only sees one party making headway on the state level.
Statewide, I don't see enough of an influence outside of the Libertarians to win any seats.
That may not be the only problem facing voters disenchanted with the two-party system. ECU's Dr. Eamon believes the number of truly independent voters, those who don't favor one political party over another, is small. Though their voter registration documentation says unaffiliated, many are, in reality, a Democrat or Republican in everything but name.
It includes people on the left and the right, especially the moderate left and the moderate right, but there are some genuine independents, genuine swing voters who can in presidential races and in other races go either way. But I would say that the genuine independents would be down around 10%. Some argue even lower than 10%.
This is a drawback to the independent trend in Mr. McCondo's opinion. As fractured as the two major political parties are, they still give members something to rally around. He says independence gives him flexibility, but not empowerment.
You know, last presidential election, I wanted to vote Green, but Jill Stein was not on the ballot. And being independent and generally leaning towards a third party, you inherently feel powerless. I don't want to put my name behind something I hate and get it.
On the other hand, Ms. Bigelow believes unaffiliated voters are becoming an increasingly powerful bloc and an answer to partisanism in the American Republic, present since the first modern Congress met 227 years ago.
We're the United States of America. We're supposed to be united. We have one president for everyone. We don't have one president for the Democrats, and the Republicans sit here and wait till he gets out of there, and then we can all breathe a sigh of relief and put our guy back in.
North Carolina has always had an independent streak, and now it is among the most unpredictable states on the electoral map. President Obama won and lost the state in 2008 and 2012, respectively, by the narrowest of margins. Counties with the closest margins both years included Nash, Lenoir, and Hyde. Pollsters seem stumped when discussing the old North state, and it seems unaffiliated voters play no small part in that. Who can say which candidate will receive the state's 15 electoral votes? North Carolina may even surprise the nation, even the likes of C.L. Cook, and give them to a third party candidate. I'm Chris Thomas.
According to the PTSD Foundation of America, one in three returning troops are being diagnosed with serious post-traumatic stress disorder, and less than 40% will seek help. An event happening next Saturday in Jacksonville hopes to turn that number around here in eastern North Carolina by connecting veterans and active duty military with local resources. Mac McKee speaks with outpatient counselor and certified trauma specialist Dawn Wren about the free PTSD awareness event.
Post-traumatic stress disorder is a medical condition that is diagnosed when someone has directly experienced a traumatic event and has symptoms of intrusion or re-experiencing the trauma, avoidance symptoms, negative changes in their mood or belief about themselves, and symptoms of hyperarousal that go on for longer than a month.
What are the percentages of active duty personnel and veterans in North Carolina with PTSD?
There are not specific standards for North Carolina. However, in the general population, 7 to 8% of the population is diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. In the service member population, and we're speaking specifically of service members from Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom, there's a diagnostic standard of about 11 to 20%. Most clinicians feel that that may actually be lower.
And what are the effects of PTSD on military families, both in terms of financial and social cost?
Family can suffer from caregiver strain. The other spouse may have to scale back on job responsibilities. Also, relational stressors, especially related to the emotional numbing that goes along with post-traumatic stress disorder. You may have a hard time feeling or behaving lovingly towards your spouse. Doesn't mean you don't love them, but it's not as obvious. The divorce rate in military families is a little higher than the average. And additionally, you see dependent spouses or children, there's a higher rate of mental health concerns there, too.
Now, with the heightened awareness of PTSD in society in general and military communities in particular, is there a specific or a success rate for controlling symptoms or even curing the disorder, or is it just an ongoing process of treatment?
There's no cure in the traditional sense, but the symptoms can resolve to the point that you don't meet criteria for the disorder. You will still be at risk for possible symptoms increasing or seeing a change in symptoms, but recovery is possible, and there is a possibility for quality of life, and that's the important thing.
Post-traumatic stress disorder has been heavily studied as both a medical problem and social problem. Why has it been such a difficult issue to come to grips with?
I think that's a problem that you see in a lot of mental health treatment. There was a lot of stigma and a lack of understanding when it came to disorders of mental health. And as we have learned more and our technology has increased, we are now aware that mental health and physical health really are the same thing. It's all connected. And that, you know, these are things that you can see on an MRI or on scans of the brain. We also realized that initial attempts at tracking PTSD really focused on the immediate period following combat. There was not a lot of study into the long-term effects, and now we know better.
On June 4th, they're holding a PTSD awareness event. Now, not only will there be informational speakers on the subject, there's going to be community resource support services and networking available.
For active duty, there are some limitations on their sources of medical treatment because most of them are offered on base, but there are some resources that are available to them also without referral, so they will be able to get more information about that. And for our retirees, same kind of thing, but they do have more resources available to them because they're acting on the insurance rather than the active duty. Also, there will not only be medical providers, there will also be supportive therapies and activities that are considered helpful, peer support, groups. Project Healing Waters is a fishing group, and people need to be plugged in. They need support. They need people who understand what they're going to, and that is a protective factor for symptom expression.
Coastal Carolina Neuropsychiatric Center's Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Awareness event is going to be taking place Saturday, June 4th, 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. And if you need more information, you can head to the events calendar at publicradioeast.org. Dawn, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you so much.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. I have received lots of calls, emails, and samples this spring of apple and pear trees. Many of these samples have been for a disease called fire blight, one of the most devastating and difficult to control diseases of fruit trees. Unfortunately, our spring's wet weather has been very conducive to fire blight development. This disease is caused by a bacteria, Erwinia armillabra, which can spread rapidly when the environmental conditions are right. The bacteria can enter plants through the flower blossoms or wounds, such as those caused by wind or hail damage, both of which we've had this year. Infected flowers or leaves turn black and die. The disease moves down the branch, resulting in the death of young twigs, which blacken and curl over. This produces the classic shepherd's crook look, as the leaves on the affected branch wilt and blacken, giving the plant a fire-scorched appearance. If you look closely at the bark, slightly sunken areas called cankers appear on branches, sometimes on the main stem. Insects and rain can spread the disease from plant to plant. Fire blight is most commonly seen on apples and pears, but other plants such as crabapple, pyracantha, hawthorn, quince, and loquat can also be affected. There's no cure for fire blight, so disease prevention is extremely important. Bradford pears, those are the ornamental pears that we see planted frequently along roadways and driveways, is fairly resistant to fire blight. When Bradford pear is infected, it tends to compartmentalize the disease well, losing only inches of branches to the disease in a season. However, these cankers can serve as a reservoir of disease for subsequent seasons. More susceptible varieties of pears and apple can see more damage, sometimes losing several feet of branch in a season. You can reduce the spread of fire blight by removing and destroying all affected plant parts after the window for disease development is passed. A warm, dry period during the summer or pruning during the winter dormant season are good times to manage this disease. All of your pruning cuts should be made a minimum of 8 to 12 inches below any sign of affected tissue. Dispose of all infected prunings away from the orchard and sanitize pruning shears between cuts. A 10% household bleach solution or Lysol can be used to dip your pruners between cuts and reduce disease transmission from tree to tree. If not pruned out, these cankers will continue to spread the disease in subsequent seasons. So whether it's the tree in your backyard or the trees that you see along the side of the road, that classic scorched appearance may signal fire blight.
Public Radio East is proud to be the media sponsor for the Ocracoke Festival, June 3rd, 4th, and 5th on Ocracoke Island. The free three-day celebration showcases musicians, artisans, and the culture and heritage of the island and eastern North Carolina.
I'm David Tweedy, director of the Ocracoke Festival. Started 17 years ago. It's a wonderful community event. I've been working with nonprofit Ocracoke Alive. I'm bringing musicians who we've run into, become friends from all around the country. Kaira Ba is a wonderful African group from Chapel Hill area. We've got more traditional music sort of groups. The Oak Grove String Band, Bluegrass Band, will be joining us. We've got world music. There's a group, De Tierra Caliente, from Puerto Rico. It's a wide range of different types of music. We also incorporate storytellers. Donald Davis is a resident of Ocracoke Island, and he's also a world-renowned storyteller. We also incorporate regional artisans. They run the gamut. We've got basket makers, pottery artists, woodworkers, of course, your fine art painting. We like to think that the festival brings together great music and stories, great visual arts, great food, and the great environment that you find when you come out here to the island. The festival takes place throughout the village of Ocracoke, June 3rd through 5th. For more information on this nonprofit event, go to publicradioeast.org events calendar.